the Make an Impact podcast presented by the American Association of Suicidology. I'm Chris Cosentino, and today we're joined by Francesca Reicherter, the founder and president of Inspiring My Generation. She holds a master's degree in information systems and operations management from the University of Florida and is currently pursuing her master's in psychology at Pepperdine University. Francesca, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, what inspired you to get involved in suicide prevention and ultimately make an impact by creating your own organization?
So I actually struggled with my own mental health journey. So my nonprofit's called Inspiring My Generation, and I started as a blog when I was 12 because I was so desperate to have a conversation about my mental health and what I was going through. When I was 5 years old, I was a competitive cheerleader. They put us in those tiny uniforms, and my older sister made a comment about my body in just a sibling way, but I internalized it based on the messaging I heard in the movies about how cheerleaders needed to look a certain way. And I started to immediately become kind of ashamed of how I looked and questioning every aspect of myself. And by the time I was 12 years old, I had this feeling that I wasn't going to live very long, and I was just constantly crying. I was constantly on the floor, unable to catch my breath. And then sometimes I would have these really good days where it'd be a couple of days, so high energy, so happy, so excited, full of life, and I didn't know why I could have these really high highs and these really low lows. And I needed to talk about it. But anytime I tried to talk about what I was feeling, it would come out in tears. And what do we say to 12-year-olds who are crying? What people would say to me was, big girls don't cry. Love that song. Hate that saying. Build a bridge and get over it. Cry me a river. All these things that really invalidated how I was feeling and made it so hard to talk about it. So I decided to start a blog. I called it Inspiring My Generation, and I was going to inspire someone to talk about it with me. That was 13 years ago. Blogging wasn't a thing yet. So what do middle schoolers do? They tease you for doing something different, for standing out, for having emotions, which is a human normal thing. So I internalized that even more, but was so determined to talk about it that when I was 15, turned it into a podcast called Inspiring My Generation. That was 10 years ago. Podcasting wasn't a thing. I was way ahead of my time, but I just kept trying to talk about it. And the more I talked about it, the more people would invalidate me, gaslight me, make me feel more alone in it. And by the time I went off to college, I was really struggling. I was not eating. I was getting very, very thin. My school actually required me to see a nutritionist a few times a week and get my blood drawn by the doctor to make sure that I was healthy and safe because I was getting really thin, really weak, and really sick. Very grateful for that. But I just was not in a good place. And what really helped me at that time was my grandparents. My grandmother would be up all night on FaceTime with me, listening to me study and read my notes. My grandfather would FaceTime me every morning for a cup of coffee, every day after class, and every night over dinner. They just made me feel so loved and so important. So I was doing my best and trying to get through for them, and it was going to work out because that's what they tell you. You graduate college and life works out. Well, I'm getting ready to graduate, and not only am I getting ready to graduate, I'm doing it in 2.5 years because I was determined to prove I was good enough. I'm getting ready to go through my last final exams. My grandparents get into a car accident the Saturday before finals. I lost my grandfather, almost lost my grandmother. And I had never learned how to cope. I never learned how to grieve. I never learned how to take care of myself. And I was struggling. I ended up attempting suicide on Christmas Eve about a month later, and my uncle talked to me about mental health, had the first conversation with me about all these different things that could impact how you're feeling. Nutrition, you know, what you're eating, what you put into your body, different vitamins if your vitamin levels are off or your nutrients are off, just these small things, your hormone levels could be off. Talked to me about moving my body and just how going for a walk can make a difference. Talk to me about therapy, about medication, but all these things that could impact how I was feeling. And I realized I desperately needed a conversation. All these years, I needed a conversation. I needed someone to validate it. And that's what he did. Promised we were going to get through this together. 27 days later, I lost him to suicide. And my heart shattered because he understood. And without any new tools, any new resources, any new coping skills, any support, without any of that, I didn't know what to do. I ended up attempting suicide 2 more times, hospitalized in a psych ward, where I realized I wasn't the only one who didn't have access to resources or conversations or tools. I wasn't the only one feeling this way or going through it. And I decided that that blog I had started when I was 12, that podcast I tried to do when I was 15, it was meant to be more than a blog or a podcast. It was meant to be a place of hope, a voice for people who no one was listening to, who were barely hanging on. It was meant to be just a safe space full of hope. And that's when I decided I was going to turn it into a nonprofit.
Thank you. It's, you know, you mentioned how your uncle died by suicide just 27 days after having that conversation with you. I think it's important to note that research has proven that talking about suicide it won't lead to other suicides. But I'm curious to know, when you're trying to normalize this conversation, what barriers have you seen or experienced when you try to open up and really have these conversations?
I'd say the biggest one, honestly, has been people not knowing how to respond. I've realized that it's not necessarily that no one wants to talk about it. There's some people who really don't, who feel really uncomfortable with it. But there's also people who just don't know what to say, and they think they're saying the right thing. Recently, I talk about my mental health all day, every day. I'm all for it. I will bond with my waiter over being in the same psych ward. I am that person. However, someone recently who had known me for not too long, maybe a year, didn't know my mental health journey. I don't know how it never came up. I guess it didn't. And they had found out. And after having a couple of drinks, they looked at me and was like, "Is it true?" And I'm like, "Is what true?" They're like, "That you tried to kill yourself? How could you do that?" And it was them feeling so heartbroken by it that I would have experienced that. It was coming from a place of love and care, but they had never had a conversation like that before. So it made them feel like it was this dirty little secret that no one could know. And that's what I've realized. Because a lot of people have never had these conversations before, it feels like maybe it's this dirty little secret. Can we talk about it? What do we say? A lot of times we just react out of love and fear. So instead of saying, "How can I support you?" we want to solve it. And you can't solve it for someone. The best thing you can do is just be there and offer support and listen. Ask them how you can be there. So I would say that for me, the biggest barrier is people simply never having a conversation before and not knowing what's appropriate to say or how to approach the conversation in general.
We always hear words matter. Why do you think words matter so much when talking about mental health and suicide?
I think that words and what you say and how you say it impact someone's comfort and safety around you. If you are using stigmatizing language, if you are calling someone bipolar for changing their mind, it's going to impact how I feel opening up to you because you are referring to someone as bipolar in a way to call them crazy for changing their mind because you're upset with them. And now as someone who lives with bipolar 2 disorder, I am going to feel uncomfortable knowing that. Well, I personally don't feel uncomfortable with it because I'm used to it. But a lot of people in the beginning, I would feel uncomfortable that, oh no, what are they going to think of me? They're going to think I'm crazy. Something's wrong with me. They're not going to want to hang out with me. They're going to do all these things. So just language in general matters because it impacts whether someone feel safe talking to you and knows that you're going to be there.
Well, obviously you were close with your uncle. What advice do you have for folks who might have just lost someone to suicide, and how you've been able to cope with that grief?
That's a really good question. I'd say, honestly, in the beginning, something I used to do was try to figure out why and try to go back to every single moment that led up to it and what could have been different, and trying to blame myself or find why it could have been my fault and take that on. And that was the worst thing I could do, because first of all, so many things lead up to someone feeling the way that they do. As someone who's attempted, I can say it was never just one single moment that impacted my decision whether or not to attempt. It were so many things that went into it, that went through my head in those moments. So I'd say, instead of focusing so hard on trying to make yourself guilty for it and make yourself this cause and trying to figure out why it's your fault, focus more on supporting yourself through it, in a sense of self-love and how you can be there for yourself, how you can be there for those around you, and use that to open the conversation with other people, because chances are someone else is struggling. Someone else around you may have these thoughts, and you may even have these thoughts. And that doesn't mean that you're not going to get through this. It just means that you need conversation. So instead of focusing so hard on what we can't change and can't control, and I know that feels impossible to do right now, focus on how you can start the conversation with someone else and offer that support that you wish you could have offered to that other person now, so that we can hopefully help other people get through it too.
Your organization, Inspiring My Generation, is geared to a younger audience, a younger crowd, I would assume. I guess one of the hot topics of conversation in the mental health world is social media. I've got a 10-year-old daughter. You know, she loves YouTube. She loves, you know, checking out all, you know, TikTok videos, things like that. I'm curious to get your thoughts on social media and mental health for the younger audience. And what are some things that parents might be able to do to help manage or monitor their child's social media use to protect them from any content that might be hazardous or dangerous?
First, I'd say social media is neither all good nor all bad, and it really depends on how we use it and what we're following. For so many people, it's their first time hearing a conversation about mental health when something pops up. For a lot of people, it's that support and validation post that went out, but positive message, letting them know that they're not alone. But for a lot of people, it's also a place of cyberbullying, of heat, of pain. So paying attention to what accounts you're following, how you're feeling while you're scrolling, and for parents, having these conversations with your kids, checking in, what are some of these accounts that you're following? What do you like about social media? Not in an interrogative, what are you doing, why are you doing this way, but in a, I'm interested to know what you're interested in and what you're following, because the algorithm is going to impact what they see. Social media is not all good or all bad. It's based on these algorithms. And if you're following a bunch of people who look a certain way or act a certain way, that's what you're going to see. And are these people that you look up to that are leading positive change, or these people that maybe may make you feel insecure or that aren't doing the best, making the best decisions? So paying attention to who you're following, who your kids or your loved ones, your family members are following, and just checking in, asking how you feel. It doesn't have to be about completely restricting their access. It can be a big step, can be just helping them shift their algorithm to something that is supportive toward them and their needs.
Interesting. Yeah, it's, I'm curious to know, you have years of lived experience with this, and now that you're pursuing your master's degree in psychology, through your studies, what have you learned in the classroom that you were not aware of through your own personal experience?
That's a good question. Actually, I was taking a psychopharm final exam last night, which is about medication with your mental health and how to support a client who's maybe thinking about taking medication, who wants to have a conversation with a psychiatrist, who's maybe experiencing side effects and wants to know more. And one thing that I didn't realize is how many different options there are and how many different ways there are to approach the conversation. For so long, I heard it as medication's bad, it causes side effects. I take a mood stabilizer, by the way, I want to premise this. I take a mood stabilizer every day. I am pro medication when it's right for you. I'm not any way against it. But the messaging I initially received made me against it for so long and kept me from getting help because it was all the side effects are bad. Once you start, you can't stop. It's addicting and all this stuff. And in some cases, side effects may not be the great. There are ones that don't have great side effects. There are ones that may cause certain side effects that you don't want. There are ones that may be more addicting. But there's not only one class of medication. And there's not only one type in each class of medication. So what I didn't realize is there's a lot more than what we're hearing online and the messaging we're getting. So that psychopharm exam was a great reminder because anxiety medications, benzos are known to be a little bit more addicting. It's something you want to be a lot more careful with. But that's not the only type of medication that can help with anxiety. So learning that just because you see something online doesn't mean that's the only option and the best thing we can do is have a conversation. And I think school's taught me that a lot.
Have you, now you mentioned you're pro medication. What about therapy? Have you had a positive experience with therapy? Have you, you have tips on selecting the right therapist? Because that's a conversation that a lot of people have. And unfortunately, a lot of times people say, I just haven't found the right therapist or I haven't found the right person to speak with about this. What are your thoughts on therapy? And if you have any tips on selecting the right therapist?
I am definitely pro therapy as a future therapist. I am pro therapy when you have the right therapist and you have a goal for what you want out of therapy. I think going to therapy without any goal can be, I don't want to say it's not helpful, but I want to say that sometimes it can be more difficult to get what you need out of it when you don't know at all what you're looking for. So I love approaching therapy as my goal is to learn more coping skills. My goal is to help manage my bipolar 2 disorder symptoms. My goal is to explore who I am and understand different facets of myself. My goal is to understand how I'm feeling and learn how to process it, learn how to reframe my thoughts. Having some kind of goal in mind can really make the difference because then you know what kind of therapist you need. Are you the person who wants a therapist that is going to focus on maybe your early attachments and help you with relationships? Or do you want a therapist who's maybe going to help you reframing your thoughts? So based on your goals, that can help you find a therapist that has a theoretical orientation that can help you, which is basically like the method they use and the theory that they're following. And a lot of therapists use a combination of many, but it's really helpful when you have some kind of goal in mind because it helps you figure out what kind of therapist. And that makes it a lot easier to go through the therapeutic process. But for finding the right therapist outside of knowing what you're looking for out of therapy, I think it's also important to make sure you feel safe when you're talking to this therapist. Are you wondering if they're judging you? Are you wondering what they're thinking? Are you wondering if it's okay to talk about it, or do you feel safe and secure? Do you feel like you can ask questions to your therapist? Do you feel like they're willing to answer your questions? Do you feel like they're listening and genuinely care? And I hope the answer is yes to all of that with every therapist you ever experience. But the truth is, not every therapist is going to be the right fit for you. So making sure that when you talk to them, you're not questioning yourself and your self-worth is a huge piece. And also knowing that you can ask them questions and interview them to make sure they're the right fit. You can ask them, like, have you ever worked with a patient who lives with bipolar 2 disorder before? Have you ever helped someone learn new behaviors to help them get out of toxic relationships? Have you worked with someone with my cultural background or religious background? You can ask them these questions to make sure that they do have some level of confidence within what you're looking for. And if they don't, are they willing to educate themselves? Are they willing to do the work outside? Because maybe they haven't had experience yet. But if they're willing to learn alongside you and support you and go and consult with other therapists, great, they could be a good fit for you. But if they're not willing to, they haven't, maybe it's best to ask for a referral to someone who may work better for you. I would say, I don't know if that answered the question any way, shape, or form, but I am pro-therapy. I think it's really helpful when you have goals going into therapy. I think it works really great when you know what you want and have a therapist who's able to help you with those goals. And to find that's really helpful to ask the right questions and to know that you're allowed to ask questions.
Excellent. And I encourage folks to visit your website, inspiringmygeneration.org. On the site, you've got great resources. In particular, you have your workbooks. What can folks, expect when they, take a look at one of those workbooks?
Yes. So these workbooks actually, the first one started as trying to keep myself alive the first year post-psych ward. So it was called You Are Not Alone, and it was helping myself build some affirmations, some self-love statements, some coping skills, all these things I never had before, as well as a guide to having a conversation. I wanted to talk to my parents. They didn't know what to say. It's not that they didn't love me. It's not that they didn't care. It's not that they didn't want to have a conversation. They genuinely wanted to fix it for me, and they couldn't fix it. I just needed them to listen. They couldn't make the negative thoughts go away. They couldn't just say, think positive, and suddenly I was like, okay, no more suicidal thoughts. Thank you. It didn't happen like that for me. So I created a conversational guide. And I'm like, these are questions you can ask me. This is what you can say. Here's a sample script. And one day I was looking at it and I was like, wow, I wonder if other people would enjoy that. So workbook one was born, and it's called You Are Not Alone. It's those affirmations, self-love statements, checking in with yourself and someone else, validating someone else, building coping skills. And in the end, you have this emotional wellness toolbox. So when you are struggling, you have it written down, a plan right in front of you of places you can go, people you can talk to, things you can do, reasons you love yourself, affirmations you can say, ways you can validate yourself. Just little survival kit on a piece of paper. The second one was I Am. And that was year two post-psych ward. I was learning to advocate for myself a little bit more. I wanted to not only survive, but gain new support and tools when I needed them. So I was learning, feeling confident in who I am and how I'm feeling, what I want, and then being able to ask for it. Being able to say, hey, mom, I need a hug. I need a new therapist. Asking my therapist, can you help me build some coping skills? Asking my teachers, I'm a little overwhelmed right now, and I'm not sure the best way to approach your class. Can you help me put together some kind of plan? Being able to ask for what I wanted based on what I was feeling and what I needed. The next workbook was How Are You? And that's a 30-day check-in with yourself, because someone once asked me what your baseline is. And I was like, I have no idea. I don't know how I feel at a normal every day. So I started tracking how I was feeling and seeing when my thoughts would get more negative and how could I encourage myself. When my thoughts were more positive, how was I feeling? How can I keep that up? So that was How Are You? Then this year's was self-care, or I guess when this comes out, it'll be last year's, 2023 was self-care. And that's learning how to build self-care routines that work for you. Adding in these practices, because TikTok told me self-care was moisturizer. And when I called my dad and explained I needed $300 for moisturizer to cure my depression, he was very confused. So I learned more about what I actually needed. And it was not that I needed new moisturizer, although I am pro-moisturizer as well. I needed to find 5 minutes in my day to take a few deep breaths and go for a walk. I needed to find 30 seconds to do a breathing exercise. I needed to find a couple of minutes to make a cup of tea and just decompress. I needed to find things that worked for me within my schedule, self-care. And then the workbook coming out in 2024 is your thoughts matter, and that's just learning to reframe your thoughts and shift from I'm feeling overwhelmed, I'm failing at everything, nothing's going the way I planned, to I'm actually having this thought because I'm worried about my future. I'm worried about if I'm on the right track. I'm worried about if I can do this. So let me reframe it to right now I'm feeling overwhelmed, but I'm doing my best, and my best is always going to be good enough. I'm proud of myself. I've come so far, and I'm going to get through this. Just learning to take what you're feeling, figure out the purpose, and shift it to encourage you through. So those are the workbooks in a nutshell.
That is excellent. That is excellent stuff. And like I said, I encourage folks to visit your website, inspiringmygeneration.org. Finally, you know, just to close things out, I would like to hear what your advice would be for someone who might be going down that same road that you've been on for so many years.
I would say my advice is twofold. First, it's find one thing that gives you hope that you can hold on to in those darkest moments. For me, it's these like exciting moments that I get to spend with my grandmother. She has Alzheimer's. I love her. I fly across the country every week to spend time with her. So when I'm feeling really, really down, I just think about the next thing we're going to do together. And that makes me excited and helps me keep going till tomorrow. And then the other piece is don't be afraid to reach out. One thing I like to do is send texts to my friends and when I'm feeling okay, actually, and say, if I was struggling, what's something you would say to me? And hearing them say, you're needed, you're loved, I believe in you, you're going to get through this, not only is a great reminder and something I can save for later, but it's a reminder that they know what to say and I can reach out to them because they'll respond and they care. So not being afraid to reach out for support, whether it's from a friend, from a family member, from a teacher, from a mental health professional, from anyone in your life, don't feel like you have to suffer in silence. Reach out, you deserve it. And find those little moments of hope that you can hold on to get through the day. Because if you can get to midnight, you made it through the day, and now you have a new chance. So just get through the day with that little bit of hope.
That's wonderful. Francesca, thank you so much for joining the show. We wish you all the best moving forward, and please, please, please keep making an impact out there.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.